From Iowa Public Radio News, I'm Ben Kiefer. This is The Exchange. In the first half hour, we hope to find out what changes in Iowa education may be coming our way when we welcome Governor Branstad's new education director, Jason Glass, into our studio. Glass is an Ohio education consultant, former teacher, and administrator who has a reputation as a school reformer. Then a recent conversation I had with political economist and former Secretary of Labor under President Clinton, Robert Reich. Reich had been scheduled to speak in Des Moines and Iowa City this week, but had to cancel due to illness. Perhaps he also had a sixth sense about the storm. Reich will give us his take on the U.S. economy and his worries about the growing gap between rich and poor. What questions do you have for Iowa's new education director? We get started with that discussion right after this news. It's The Exchange from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Later in the hour, a recent conversation I had with Robert Reich, the former Secretary of Labor under President Clinton. He'll give us his take on the U.S. economy and his worries about the growing gap between rich and poor. First, though, education in Iowa. Our state has a new director of the Department of Education, appointed by Governor Branstad. His name is Jason Glass. Glass is 39 years old, an Ohio education consultant, former teacher and administrator who has a reputation as a school reformer. Jason Glass joins us from the studios of Iowa Public Radio in Des Moines. Good afternoon. I hope it wasn't too much trouble getting through the snow to the studio.
Hi, Ben. No, it wasn't too bad at all. Of course, we're not too far away from the studio here, so it was just a little run up the hill. The storm is just amazing coming in, though. It's been fun to watch. I know lots of folks are scared, so I hope everybody that's here gets where they need to be.
Yes. Okay. Let's get to talking about this. We want to reach out to our listeners for this half hour while Jason Glass joins us. We want to hear about our listeners' concerns about education in Iowa. What would you like to see change? A lot of issues to talk about: teacher pay, Iowa's core curriculum, vouchers instead of universal preschool, the summer education summit proposed by the governor as well. 1-866-780-9100. 1-866-780-9100 with your education concerns. Our email, theexchange@iowapublicradio.org. Jason Glass, let's just start off by having you list your highest priorities for change in Iowa education.
Sure, Ben. Well, I think it really comes on two fronts. One is around improvement, and the other is around innovation. I'll elaborate on those a little bit more. In terms of improvement, I think there are many areas about our education system. Well, let me back up. I've been in Iowa about 2 weeks now. Just had a chance to visit with so many great educators, great community leaders, fantastic people here. And I can tell you the system that you have here isn't broken. There is a strong foundation on which we can build. But practically everybody that I've talked to has said there are aspects of the education system here that we can make improvements on. And so what I'm about, you know, in your introduction of me, you said I'm an education reformer. I prefer to think of myself really as somebody that helps schools improve. And that's really what I'm going to be about, is on those areas that we know we have problems in our education system. Let's confront those. Let's work together to find answers and solutions to those, and really lean into the hard problems.
Okay, in your short time here, what are those areas? List them that you've been hearing that Iowa does have problems, and where we can build, where you see.
Sure. Well, I think in the short term we've got a budget issue to handle, and so you know that's going through the legislative process right now. The other important aspect where my focus will be is on innovation, and I want to see schools try new things. And I think you've got a great example of innovation with these one-to-one schools in Iowa that are really leading the nation in terms of bringing one-to-one technology or an iPad or a laptop or some device into each kid's hands. Not that that's necessarily the complete solution to curing all the woes of public education. There is no single silver bullet cure for anything, but I think that's a great example of innovation. I'd like to see more of that.
Okay. There's a move to dump the Iowa Core Curriculum, which is a statewide blueprint for what students should learn in school. Now, teachers and principals have been spent more than 2 years preparing for the switch to the $31 million Iowa Core. It was approved by lawmakers in 2008. What is the status of the Iowa Core curriculum, and what's your position? Dump it?
Right. Well, right now, where it's at in the legislative process is that the funding appears to have been pulled on it so far, the funding for the implementation of the Iowa Corps. Ben, we have to look at the legislative – it really is a process. And so the House, the Senate, the governor, all the advocacy groups that are at the Capitol right now all get to weigh in on that. And so where we are today may not necessarily be where we end up in a couple of months. Where I stand on the Iowa Corps – and I've been tried to be really clear about this from the beginning – is I think that the Iowa Corps was a move in the right direction. I think especially when the state emerged it with the Common Core standards, it really lifted the rigor and relevance of those core standards to something that we should be aspiring to all across the country, skills in math, reading, writing that we would hope kids all over the country would reach. So I support the continued work of the Iowa Corps. I do think that there's more work to be done. And as I've traveled around the state and talked with people, some of the educators that have been working on this, that have been heavily invested in this work, they will tell you that it's not finished, that there's more work to be done and there are places that we can make improvements to it. So where I hope we go is we continue the work and continue to evolve the Iowa Corps to really spell out for schools where kids should be shooting. What are the core sets of knowledge, skills, abilities that they need going into this new century?
So how will that affect 2 years in the preparation for the implementation of it? What you're saying will change that implementation? If so, how?
I think it will. Well, when the funding, if the funding gets pulled, it's certainly going to have an effect on how we implement this. But Ben, I think frankly, this is not something that we can do from the state level anyway. This is work that has to happen in the field. I mean, the educators working, the classroom educator, the building principal, the district administration, the local communities and school boards, those are the people that are doing the work, particularly the classroom teacher. And so what we have to do, I think, is unite together the people in the field that are really interested in doing this work and help them in letting it grow, letting it evolve, letting it continue. So that will really be my focus. If the funding gets on this gets pulled, then I'm going to go to the people in the field who have a love for curriculum work and standards work and turn it over to them and enable them to continue the work.
Mm-hmm. Now, many states, including Iowa, have adopted national Common Core standards in the past few years to position themselves for these millions of dollars for the federal Race to the Top competition. Now, Iowa has been shut out of the competition twice. Do you see us the Iowa Corps having anything to do with that?
You know, I'm not sure, and I've only been here a couple of weeks, so I think there's a lot more I need to learn about the local context and what happened in the Race to the Top applications in the past are something I need to learn more about. I think, you know, I was in Colorado, actually, for about 10 years before I was in Ohio, and was there during that state's Race to the Top application. And Colorado really had a very aggressive program to go after those Race to the Top dollars and ended up not getting it. Secretary Duncan actually apologized to Colorado and Louisiana and some other states that really went out on a limb to try and meet what they thought was what the administration was going for in Race to the Top and didn't get it. So I think there are some questions about how the scoring went down, how that happened, that the U.S. Department of Education has acknowledged have been some problems. I think regardless of what you think about Race to the Top, you have to argue that it was an incredibly effective approach for getting states and districts around the country to really break some traditions and try some innovations, do some new things. Now, there's a lot of argument and discussion about whether those were the right things, whether it was the right approach, but we had states and districts around the country shed processes, traditions that had been going on for almost a century in an effort to get some of that cash. So I'm interested more so in how we can use an approach like that to spur more innovation in Iowa than I am what the outcomes of Race to the Top were.
If you just joined us, my guest this half hour, Jason Glass, the new director of the Department of Education. And if you have a question or a comment for Mr. Glass, 1-866-780-9100 or the exchange at iowapublicradio.org. Your concerns, questions about education in Iowa. Let's talk about teacher pay reform. You want to reform that in the state. In Colorado, you oversaw the county school district's performance pay system. What did you learn from that experience, and how will that perhaps feed into how you want to reform teacher pay in our state?
Right. Well, again, I think, you know, the first step is to change the way we talk about education. And it's not reform, it's improve. I think everybody can get behind the concept of improving education. And one of the, from the national perspective on this, the national debate, one of the unfortunate things that I see is that we tend to get shoved into this education reform camp that's all about trying to dismantle what is really a quality public education system in this country. Or you get shoved into this status quo traditionalist camp, and there's no room in between. And so where I hope to come at on this is how do we walk the middle path between these two gangs of people on the extremes and try to bring people together about how we improve schools. So that's where I'm going to try and go. In terms of the question of teacher compensation, I think the answer to how you reform it or how you improve it, which is how I'd like to really talk about it, is that you do it with people. Places where we've seen the compensation systems make dramatic improvements are places like Denver, Baltimore, and there are a number of districts all over the country now that are adopting some really aggressive changes to their compensation systems for teachers. And it's happening where the teachers are actually involved in that conversation. So that will be my approach, is how do we make these improvements together? Mm-hmm. I think we have to think about, 80% of the resources that we put into public education go into people's salary and benefits. And so if we're not addressing and confronting and talking about how we're using the greatest expenditure that we put into public education, we're really just tinkering with the edges. So I think this is a tough conversation, but it's one that we need to have.
What is your appraisal? Granted, you've only been here for 2 weeks, but your appraisal of Iowa's system of teacher evaluation?
Well, I think it's better, actually, than most other states in the country, in that the teacher evaluation system here, I think there was a law passed about 5 years ago, the teacher quality bill, that included some significant changes to teacher evaluation. And the fact that across the whole state of Iowa, there was some attention paid to validity and reliability. Validity meaning, does the teacher evaluation instrument, is it a measure of quality teaching? So Iowa has paid attention to that and has tried to put in a teacher evaluation system that's valid, meaning it is a measure of quality teaching. Believe it or not, that's unusual across the country. Most of these evaluation systems are something that somebody made up in an office and handed out. The other thing that Iowa has done well in that regard is in teacher evaluation is that they paid attention to the reliability aspect as well, or consistency. There are trainings that evaluators in Iowa have to go to be able to administer that evaluation. So they've done some things really well in having an instrument that's linked to quality teaching, and they're paying attention to how it's administered consistency. So those two components alone put you way ahead of the pack. Now, that's not to say that we can't make improvements in teacher evaluation.
You see weaknesses already there?
Sure. While it's a strong foundation to build on, it's also a system that's been laid aside for a few years, and we should never lay it aside. We should never lay aside the work of improving teaching and learning. And so this should be a constant state of evaluating, is this system working? Is this aligned to good teaching? What are we learning? How do we keep improving? So we need to start that work again. Pick up this document. Bring people together who know a lot about teaching and learning, and there are a lot of them in the state of Iowa, and have them pick up the work of working on that document again. I'd also really like to see us get teachers more involved in that evaluation process. So how do we create some teacher roles in schools, master teacher, mentor teacher, or teacher coach positions that create conversations about what good teaching looks like, what great learning looks like, and how we can create collaborative groups where teachers work together and learn from each other. So I think there are opportunities for us to make improvements to a teacher evaluation system here that has some strengths.
Director of Education Jason Glass is with us. We have about 10 minutes left of this conversation. Let's make sure we get to the phones and see as many comments and questions from our listeners there. Dennis, sounds like you've got a bad phone line, Dennis. Perhaps we can hear you. Calling from Cedar Rapids. Hello, can you hear us?
Yes, I can hear you just fine.
Okay, you're good to go.
We okay?
Yep.
All the evaluation tools are only as good as the administrators, using them. Administrators, as far as I'm concerned, and I'm a retired teacher and administrator of 36 years experience, administrators need to get out into the classrooms on a regular basis, both formally and informally. And I think it's critical in the teaching profession, this happens in other professions, that people who are not making the grade need to receive guidance to say you need to do something else for a living. And that needs to happen within the first 2 years. Otherwise, administrators get complacent, teachers get complacent, and nothing changes. Teachers know who the good teachers are. Teachers in the building know who the inefficient teachers are. I'll take my answer off the air.
Dennis, thank you for calling for Cedar Rapids. So let's address that. What would you like to see changed about the way Iowa administrators can deal with weak teachers?
Right. Well, I'd first say that I have a hard time disagreeing with anything Dennis said. He's right that administrators do need to be out in classrooms. Administrators need to be the instructional leader of the building. He's also right that the teachers in the building, the administrators in the building, I'd take it a step further to say the kids and the parents in the buildings know who the good teachers are and they know who the less effective teachers are. I would like to, as I just said, I'd love to see us move toward a system where we get more teachers involved in that conversation, more teachers involved in that evaluation process, where we've got some sharing of ideas, some collaboration happening. In regard to teacher dismissal and the issue of that, I think that there's a hyper focus on that around the country as an effective method of really reshaping public education. I think it's an area where we can make improvements. The systems that we have around teacher dismissal are so onerous and lengthy and
complicated. So Iowa teachers have too much job protection. Is that what you're saying?
I'm saying that the process in place to remove an ineffective teacher is not efficient, and we need to look at that and confront that as an issue.
Okay. Now, you and Governor Branstad want to end universal preschool and instead set aside taxpayer money for vouchers for needy families to offset the cost of private preschool. Angie is joining us from Webster City. I think Angie has a question about the preschool program. Angie, go ahead.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I'd like to just share for a minute my experience. My daughter's in 4-year-old preschool, the universal program here in Webster City, and I've seen really the difference between her 3-year-old private preschool with a non-certified teacher and the program we have here now with certified teachers, a unified curriculum, transportation support, and support from the school district with all 5 preschools in town, and it's a world of difference. I can't tell you enough about how ready these kids will be for kindergarten and how important that is, and I'm sure you'll agree with me on that, but I just think that vouchers would not make that kind of quality program available to everyone. And I know budget's an issue, but I really believe that preparing kids for success in the early years is really the best education money we can spend. I'll take my answer off the air.
Hey, Angie, from Webster City. Angie thinks we might be short-sighted here. She sees the real benefits of this universal preschool, which now under the Branstad administration will come to an end. It's replaced by taxpayer money for vouchers. Instead,
well, I have many points that I would agree with Angie on. The quality early childhood education program is extremely important, and it's particularly important for kids in poverty. And so that's where, in a time of economic contraction, that's where we've got to focus those resources. And she's right about trying to maintain quality programs with certified educators that have a quality early childhood education curriculum. So what we're trying to do is put together a program that maintains as much quality early childhood education as we possibly can for as many kids as we can. So, the governor and the legislature are going to decide what our number is, and it's going to come on the educators in the state to come up with a plan to protect as much of that as we can and try to serve as many kids as we can.
Now, the governor has called for an education summit this summer involving national school reform experts, hopefully bringing new ideas to Iowa's K-12 education system. What areas, we've talked about a few of them, perhaps you could address ones that we haven't yet addressed, chief areas you expect and want this summit to address?
Right. Well, there are a lot of folks interested in this summit, I think maybe because of Iowa's and Iowa and New Hampshire's unique place in the presidential primary process. So we've got lots of help, lots of folks offering to be involved. But I really think first and foremost, this education summit needs to be about Iowa, and it needs to be run by Iowans. And so I'm meeting next week with the members of the other education leadership groups in the state, the other associations, to talk about what do we want this to be. And I'm one voice in that conversation, along with the governor and school leaders, legislators. I mean, I'm one voice. What I can tell you, what I would like to see is a focus on the human capital process. So how do we improve and support the people working in the system? Because education is a human being driven endeavor, and if we have to think about how we improve and support the people working in the system, so that needs to be a focus. I think another focus we should look at, and you mentioned the Iowa core, we need to have a thoughtful, honest discussion about curriculum and standards and assessments. So there's a strand around that. And then the last part I'd really like to see is a focus on innovation. So how does that happen? How do we encourage it? How do we sort of unleash the tempered radicals that are in the state to do some great innovative work in education?
Jason Glass, you've worked in Ohio. You've worked in Colorado. Now you're here in Iowa. Do you have a sense of how we fit in to the context of education across the country, Iowa's strengths and perhaps its weaknesses as we finish up this conversation compared to other states?
Right. I can tell you I've also worked in Tennessee and New Jersey, so I have some multi-state experience, and I can tell you that it's a good system here, and the system has a good brand. As you go around the country and talk about Iowa's education system, people from all over the country recognize that there are generations of great educators here, and I've talked to so many people who have moved here to put their kids in this system here. So I think as we talk about reforming or improving, the word I prefer to use, education in Iowa, we should be very cognizant that the system has a good brand and we need to protect that.
Mm-hmm. Very quickly, you want to change the system for teacher training and professional development. How and why?
Sure. Well, I think the classroom teacher needs to be in charge of how that system operates. The entire bureaucracy in education needs to be turned around and configured to support that classroom teacher, because he or she, that classroom teacher in front of kids is the most important, most critical component that we have to improving and shaping student learning and student futures. So I want to put teachers in charge of that system, configure the whole system to support, deliver services to them.
Okay, so rather than having it come from the top down, you want them to come up with their own ideas for their own training and development.
Absolutely.
Mm-hmm. Okay, at least one Iowa school superintendent has said he would like to see an extension of the school year from 180 days currently to become perhaps 200 days. It says it will make us more competitive internationally. In 30 seconds, where do you stand on that?
Right. Well, I think particularly for kids from economically disadvantaged backgrounds or kids with disabilities or kids that are learning English, I mean, the truth is that it takes more resources and it takes more time to educate those kids. They have a lower starting point than kids that come out of affluent backgrounds. So we need to look at how we reconfigure, repurpose the funds that we have in our education system. If we're really going to get serious about closing the achievement gap, we've got to get more serious about how we focus attention on kids that are behind.
Okay, we've run out of time. I want to thank you very much, Jason Glass, the director of the Department of Education. I appreciate you coming in, especially with the winter weather on its way.
Thanks, Ben. Appreciate being here.
Okay, coming up in just a moment on The Exchange, a recent conversation I had with political economist and former Secretary of Labor under President Clinton, Robert Reich. That coming up in just a moment. This is The Exchange from Iowa Public Radio News. This is The Exchange on Iowa Public Radio. I'm Ben Kiefer. This half hour, a conversation with former Labor Secretary Robert Reich. During his tenure under President Clinton, Reich implemented the Family and Medical Leave Act. He successfully promoted increasing the minimum wage and launched a number of job training programs. In September of last year, his book, Aftershock, The Next Economy and America's Future, was published. At the taping of this interview, Robert Reich had scheduled three appearances this week in Iowa, one in Iowa City and two in Des Moines. Yesterday, Robert Reich was forced to cancel those appearances due to an illness. It's uncertain whether the speeches will be rescheduled.
Mr. Reich, in your book, Aftershock, The Next Economy and America's Future, you argue that the economy isn't going to get moving again until we address the fundamental problem of disparity of wealth and income. Explain what you mean by this and how fast that disparity is growing.
Well, it's really quite shocking, Ben, and the disparity is quite simple to describe. In the late 1970s, for example, the top 1%, the richest 1% of Americans, were getting about 9% of total income in this country. But then income and also wealth began concentrating more and more and more at the top, to the point that by 2007, the top 1% was actually getting 23.5%. of total national income. Now, when you get that degree of concentration, the problem is the rest of the country, the rest of the vast middle and working class of America, just doesn't have the purchasing power it needs to buy all the goods and services that keep people employed, that keep the economy going, at least without going deeper and deeper into debt. But, of course, that's not sustainable. You can't keep going deeper and deeper and deeper into debt. At some point, as we saw happening in 2007, 2008, the debt bubble bursts. And now we are in a very difficult and awkward position because although top corporations are doing well, Wall Street is doing well, the people who are at the very top of America in terms of their wealth and income are doing quite well. It's as if the Great Recession never even happened. Most Americans are not. They're still mired in recession.
Mm-hmm. So before we get on to the reforms you feel need to take place on Wall Street and other places to correct this, go back to what spurred the growth in this disparity.
Mainly technology. I mean, if you look at the 1970s, 1980s, what you see is a lot of new information and transportation technologies coming on stream. Container ships, cargo ships, satellite communication technologies, eventually the computer, eventually the internet. All of these allowed the production process to be parceled out around the globe to wherever things could be done most cheaply. Which is good from the standpoint of economic efficiency, but bad from the standpoint of a lot of American workers who were left either without jobs or with lower and lower paying jobs instead of manufacturing in the domestic service industry. That is, retail, restaurant, hotel, hospital, surface transportation, child care, elder care. You know, these jobs just don't pay very much.
Mm-hmm. So how do we make it so that it's not just Wall Street that has a fast recovery, or any recovery, that the main body of the American people do?
Well, in the short term, we're not going to fundamentally change the ability of Americans to get good jobs through their education, through job training, and so forth. That takes years to do. I think the president was right in the State of the Union saying that we do need, over the long term, to invest in people, in education, in infrastructure, research and development. But that's long term. Over the next 5 to 8 years, the only way we get money back in people's pockets is we have a much more progressive tax system combined with something called the Earned Income Tax Credit, which is a wage subsidy, and it ought to go all the way up to the middle class. Right now it's just for the poor, but it really ought to be extended to the middle class. Taxes of people in the middle ought to be cut. The first $20,000 of income should be exempt from the payroll tax, and we should make up all these revenues by increasing taxes on the only people who have really any money anymore, if you really think about where the money is in society, and that is people at the top.
Did you hear anything in the State of the Union address or otherwise from President Obama or the new Congress that would lead you to believe this is the direction that will be taken?
No, nobody wants to talk about the widening income gap. They're afraid of sounding like class warriors. They're afraid of getting the right wing all excited and upset with them. They're afraid of anytime anybody talks about the widening income gap, who's a politician, they feel that they open themselves up to criticism. Actually, I don't think they do. I think the American public would like an honest discussion of what has happened to this country, why we had the Great Recession, why it's so hard to come out of the Great Recession, and what we need to do about it, at least in the short term.
One of the major accomplishments of the Obama administration, it says, is the financial reform in its first 2 years. What did that financial reform actually accomplish and fail to accomplish that might have been possible?
Well, we don't know yet how much it accomplished. I think it did, and hopefully will make a lot of what happens on Wall Street more transparent. We will know, for example, whether banks have enough assets on their books to justify a lot of their investments and a lot of their derivatives. It is going to make derivatives themselves. These, you know, derivatives are essentially bets on bets. And these bets on bets called derivatives will be also a little bit more transparent. But what I worry about, Ben, is that overall there was nothing done in financial reform that would keep a limit on the size of the biggest banks. No antitrust or utilization, no cap on the size that big banks can get. And therefore, if and when there is another financial crisis, and I believe there will be, there are going to be a lot of banks that, once again, are too big to fail and that will have to be bailed out.
In what way will the next financial crisis be different than the one we had beginning in 2008?
Well, I hate to say it. I don't think it's going to be all that different. That is, Wall Street right now is doing a lot of what it did before because it can get such inexpensive, cheap money. The Federal Reserve Board is keeping interest rates down close to zero. The biggest banks have special drawing rights on the Fed, which means that they can even get cheaper money. And when you give investors, investment bankers, basically casino gamblers, I don't want to be too denigrating, but this is, you know, the Wall Street is a casino. When you give them free money, you are essentially asking for speculative activities, wild speculation, and Wall Street is starting to engage once again in very wild speculation.
Now, there must be another vision out there, Mr. Reich, because I can't believe everybody is of your opinion and is willing to use an Obama image, drive the car into the ditch again.
Well, nobody wants to. I think Republicans, Democrats say they certainly don't want to allow Wall Street to repeat its mistakes, and some of the regulatory agencies have more authority now. But if you look at the fine print, you'll see that the Securities and Exchange Commission, for example, the Commodities Future Trading Commission, for another example, they are not being funded. Congress is not giving them any more money for enforcement, for inspections. So these are toothless tigers. Again, Ben, I want to emphasize that Wall Street's excesses and the failure of oversight of Wall Street was a big part of the problem. But I think a more central part of the problem was that so much of the middle class in America simply could not buy unless they were going deeper and deeper into debt on the backs of the collateral in their homes. And as long as home values were going up, and as long as Wall Street was willing to back those kinds of loans, everybody seemed happy for a while. But when everything fell apart, the great, vast American middle class learned that it was all smoke and mirrors.
If you've just joined us, my guest is Robert Reich, the former Secretary of Labor under Bill Clinton. Now, President Obama has named General Electric CEO Jeffrey Immelt as the administration's economic advisor. How do you read this appointment?
Well, every president has got to reach out to the business community. No president can afford to be seen as anti-business. And big corporations do have some useful things to tell a president. The problem is that it's very important for the president not to be seduced into believing or allow the public to be seduced into thinking that the interests of big global corporations like GE or GM or any of them are identical to the interests of average Americans. They aren't. GE right now has more employees outside the United States than inside the United States. It's over the last 10 years, it's closed dozens of U.S. factories. GM is now selling and making more cars in China than in the United States. These companies are not really American companies in the sense that their fortunes rise or fall with the fortunes of America.
Then what is the value of having a CEO of General Electric there?
Well, the value is, number one, political. You need somebody to tell you whether business is feeling that you are, as a president, doing something that's basically running afoul of what business wants. You may want to do it anyway, but you want to be sure that you know that business is mustering its political muscle against you. I think one of the problems that Obama ran into is he didn't have that kind of intelligence. But number two, you want to find out from business what the economic conditions are that they're dealing with. And, of course, businesses know a great deal. But you mustn't take the advice of big business that says, in effect, we need to cut taxes on corporations, we need to reduce hourly wages, reduce the minimum wage, we need to get rid of environmental regulations, all in order to improve the so-called business climate in the United States. Well, those businesses are interested in only one thing. That's their job. It's to make money for their shareholders. That's what they're organized for. That's what they're designed for, not to create jobs in the United States and not to improve the quality of life for Americans.
Now, recent polls have indicated that the president's approval rating has improved somewhat. More than half the country, though, still disapproves of his handling of the economy. Why would that not follow in with his popularity? And how important is that approval rating for the handling of the economy?
Well, it's going to become more and more important as we get closer to the gravitational pull of the 2012 election. Right now, the president needs to be able to hold on to as much as he's accomplished, deal with a Republican House of Representatives. My fear for him and my fear for the country is that I don't see unemployment cut being reduced very much. That is, without a very strong commitment by the federal government to, for example, create jobs directly if there are no other jobs. I mean, Franklin D. Roosevelt had a Works Projects Administration for people who couldn't get any jobs any other way, and that those people helped out in classrooms, they built roads, they cleared land for national parks. I mean, at the very least, you want the federal government to be ready to create jobs for people who otherwise are just going to sit on their duffs for years.
Robert Reich, you recently wrote that the president's handling of the economy is, quote, legitimizing the Republican narrative on the economy. Explain what you mean by that.
Well, I didn't mean that his handling of the economy was legitimizing the public, the Republican narrative, but many of the decisions he was making were legitimizing the Republican narrative. The Republican narrative is we got into the trouble we got into in terms of the Great Recession because government was too big, taxes are too high, spending too high. What we need to do in order to get jobs back again is to cut down the size of government, reduce taxes, and reduce spending. That's been the Republican mantra for 30 years, but without a strong Democratic counter-narrative, which I've given you. That is, I think the central problem, and I think this is not just a counter-narrative, this is the truth, is that so much wealth and income have been concentrated at the top that the vast middle class simply doesn't have the purchasing power to keep the economy going. But without that, without the president saying that, if he simply says, okay, I'm going to freeze federal spending, non-defense discretionary, or I'm going to freeze federal salaries, or I'm going to have a deficit commission that recommends $3 of spending cuts for every dollar of tax increase, or I'm going to extend the Bush tax cuts. All of that does legitimize and tell the story that Republicans want to tell, which is that it's all about government becoming too big.
Mm-hmm. And our national debt has been growing for a growing problem for a long time. We've reported on it here on public radio for years and years. And then only in 2008 and also with the rise of the Tea Party has it become a burning point of national interest. What finally made people pay attention? Is it the narrative you just described?
Partly the narrative I described. That is, if there's no other explanation for what happened to jobs and the economy, why the Great Recession occurred, and why we're having such a difficult time getting out of it, then the Republican narrative, by virtue of being the only one standing, has more and more credibility. Ross Perot, you may remember in 1992, when we were struggling to get out of the recession of 1991, which wasn't nearly as deep as the Great Recession, Ross Perot got a lot of following by saying it's all about the government deficit. We've got to reduce the deficit and everything will be fine. So deficit hawks gain traction. And the whole notion that the problem is too much government becomes much more credible when you have severe economic stresses and declines. Now, Ben, having said that, let me say one other thing, and that is that the long-term deficit and debt is a problem. I don't mean to suggest that it's not. But the real issue is the ratio of the debt to the national product, to the GDP, to the total economy. It's that ratio that has to be brought down. And in the early 1950s, we did that. The post-war debt GDP ratio was 110%. I mean, the debt was 110% of the total economy. We brought that down not so much by cutting spending. We brought it down by growing the economy, the denominator of the equation. And that's what we have to do now.
Now, you've drawn parallels between what President Obama faces now, the threat of the economic competition from China, which we've been hearing a lot about, to what America faced in the 1980s, if we remember, when the talk was Japan's threatening of America's preeminence. How can we learn from that period and apply it to this period?
Well, the ultimate learning from the 1980s, from Japan's threat to our preeminence, was that it was a hoax. I mean, Japan was not nearly as strong as we thought it was, and Japan soon thereafter went into a death spiral. I mean, more than 10 years of almost no economic growth whatsoever. The proper analogy, it seems to me, to China is probably not in military sense, at least not now, but in sense of national and international predominance, China. And the Soviet Union. In the 1950s, 1960s, we made major investments in education, in mathematics and science, and also in a national, an entire interstate highway system. And we did it because we said we were trying to catch up with the Soviets and maintain our economic predominance, because otherwise they would eat our lunch. Obviously, it was not that. I mean, the consequence of the interstate highway system went far beyond and has had far greater effects on the economy than the Soviet menace of the 1950s, 60s, and 70s. And the same thing is true with our efforts to train a whole generation of math and science teachers. It was terribly important for the economy over the long term.
So the threat from China, which is being much talked about now, real or fiction?
Well, I think a lot of it is real, but it's not a zero-sum game, Ben. It's not as if their advance necessarily means our decline. China, if it means that China is going to be doing a lot more innovation, and that prompts us to do even more innovation, that's good. If China builds 20 universities, each one the equivalent of MIT, and that forces us to invest more in our universities and make Americans more competent and highly skilled, that's good. That's not bad.
Now, I'm interested to see that when we examine the federal budget, you break it down into past, present, future. Talk about why this is important.
Well, it's important because right now nobody... most Americans have no idea what the budget means and what's in the budget. And it's also, so it seemed to me it would be much easier for people to comprehend if we had really a division in the budget between past obligations, that is, obligations the government has made to people on the basis of their willingness to put money into the system, particularly Social Security and Medicare, and those past obligations are sacrosanct. We can't change them. If we want to change them, we have to change them for future generations that have not yet entered into those obligations. And then, secondly, a current budget, a present budget, on anything that keeps us happy and safe and well today. And that second budget has got to be balanced. We've got to have enough revenues to come in to pay for everything that we want done today to keep us secure and healthy and happy. But then you have a third part of the budget, which is the capital or investment budget. These are really investments in tomorrow's productivity, the future productivity of the country. The difference, I suppose, the simple analogy would be a family that borrows money to send kids to college. I mean, that's not bad. That borrowing is actually good. It would be irresponsible if a family didn't make that kind of borrowing. And for the federal government as a whole and the nation as a whole to borrow in order to make future investments in our productivity, as long as the returns on those investments are greater than the cost, that is, the principal and interest on those investments, we should be making them.
How hopeful are you that lawmakers will come together and make the changes necessary to stop this widening income gap and lead us back to economic prosperity?
Well, I'm not terribly optimistic in the short term, Ben, because it seems to me that all of the ways in which campaigns are financed now, particularly after that grotesque Supreme Court decision, Citizens United Against Federal Election Commission, that treats corporations as people and says that corporations have an unlimited First Amendment right to spend what they want on campaigns. How absurd can you get? In light of that, it's going to be very hard to make the kinds of changes that need to be made anytime soon. But let me just say this. This country has a history, and it goes right back to the beginning of our republic, of opting for reform rather than reaction, of doing what must be done to expand opportunity and improve the shared prosperity that we have all come to rely on for so many years. Even the top 1%, even the richest members of this society, will do better in an economy that is rapidly growing, in which they have a smaller share of a rapidly growing economy than they're doing now with a large share of an economy that is still pretty much dead in the water. They'll do better in a society that, because prosperity is more widely shared, has a politics that is a more upbeat and positive and collaborative politics than they will do now with the politics that, because so many people are so afraid and so insecure, is itself so angry and bitter.
Robert Reich, thank you very much for this conversation. It's been a pleasure.
Thanks, Ben.
Former Labor Secretary under President Clinton, Robert Reich. Reich was scheduled to make appearances this week in Iowa City and Des Moines, but canceled those appearances due to illness. The Exchange is produced by Catherine Perkins and Alex Hoyer. Podcasting and on-demand audio of The Exchange available at iowapublicradio.org. And we do always welcome your comments and questions about this program. You can contact us anytime at our email, theexchange@iowapublicradio.org. Our theme music was composed and performed by Dan Knight. The Exchange is a production of Iowa Public Radio. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.